The just in, by way of a small introduction to what I've been focusing on a little more in my Limud lately, and this is going to be an example of that, is that the Ravina Tam says something that we rely on in our lives. He interprets the directive of the Gemara in a certain way, and I want to explore how he arrives at that. The Gemara says in two places, in Maseches Kedushin and in Maseches Avodah Zarah, that a person should divide his learning time into three equal parts. Well, this is presumably a person who has a lot of learning time. If you only have an hour a day, I think the Kitzur Shulchan Aruch has a different set of rules. But this is presumably somebody who is at a stage in his life that is able to learn full time or something. So how should he structure it? So the Gemara says that he should divide it a third in Mikra, which is Chumash, Navi, Yetzuvah, a third Mishnah, and a third Gemara. And Rabbeinu Tam in the Tosfos says, hi, we don't seem to be doing this today. So he says, yeah, today we're mainly learning Talmud Bavli. He says the reason is because the Talmud Bavli is, you can incorporate all three elements by studying Talmud Bavli. He says, like the Gemara says in Sanhedrin, that they dash in their own name of their own project Bavli as a remnant to the word Belula. And Belula means it's blended. So Belula of a Mikra, Belula of a Mishnah, Belula of a Talmud, that it's a blend of Psukim and the Shnayas and Gemara type discussion. So since it's a blend, so you have all three components in the Talmud Bavli. That's what the Rebbe Tam says. So my Rebbe, Rav Yitzchak Kutner, in the Sefer Pachad Yitzchak on Yom Tov Shavuot, so yes, Prabhupada says, I don't understand. If all of Mikra appears in the Gemara at some point or another, so then you don't need to bring me that they called it Blula. It's just a fact. We know all the Mishnah is in the Gemara, so obviously that was never a problem. If you learn all the Gemara, well, if you learn what's printed as the Shas, including the Mishnah's part that have no Gemara, so basically you're going to learn all the Mishnah's and all the Gemara. That's for sure. But so the real kasha only was, why aren't we learning a third Mikra? And the answer to that is, this thing with Blue, he says, why don't you just answer? Because the Mikra is in there also, just like the Mishnah's in there. Obviously, he says, the Mikra is not all in there. So if it's not all in there, what are you gaining by saying that it's Blue? You're still not covering all the Mikra. So that's his question. Now, we think the argument should be either we have it or we don't have it, but what does Blue help me? What does that do for me? So that's his question. So and then somebody, I saw doing a little research that somebody had actually counted up all the sukkah that I brought in the Talmud Bavli, and it's basically only about 25% of all mikra that appears in Talmud Bavli. So it says something like there's 24,000 sukkah and 7,000 are in the Gemara, something like that. So if that's the case, then the whole logic breaks down. We're not really covering all the mikra. And yet we're essentially shutting down on the study of Mikra because we say we learned Talmud Bavli. So how does it work? So I offer the following solution. And now I'm trying to put it into practice. Which is that there's a Ravina Tam himself in the beginning of the third pack of Sudas, where the Gemara is trying to prove a certain point, that it brings a fragment of a pasuk. And Ravina Tam says, how does that fragment that they bring relate to our issue? He said, no, it doesn't relate. It's not that. It's the rest of the pasuk. The rest of the pasuk is what relates to our issue. And he says, and don't be surprised by that, because you find that in other places. And he brings one other example, but he acts like it's happening all the time. So he makes a rule out of it. Rashi also seems to agree with that rule, although he never sits himself down officially to study the rule, but you'll see Rashi fairly often say The Gemara brings the fragment, they say that, you know, they don't mean this fragment, they mean the end, they mean the beginning. They mean the one before, the one after. So, you see that that happens. So, I'm asking an obvious question. How could that happen? How could they possibly do that to us? You learn a piece of Gemara, they bring out a fragment, and that fragment's useless to you. So, there's another piece that's good, but you don't have that piece of Gemara, so what do they want you to do? So, obviously, that's a way of the Talmud Bavli letting us know that the structure is that when we bring a pasuk, you don't just look at the fragment we bring. It's now your responsibility to open the Chumash, or the Navi, or the Tehillim, or the Mishnah, and learn through that pasuk, and learn through it well. What's before, what's after, get the sense of text and context, and then come back and finish the piece of Gemara. So now, Rabbi Natan, following his own opinion, makes perfect sense, because it's blula, by blula. What the Gemara means when it says it's blended, they mean that we've mixed in enough mikra here, that if every time we bring a pasuk, you stop and learn it, and the surrounding material, you will end up covering all the mikra by going through Talmud Bavli. So, if that's the case, if I'm right, then that should change the way we learn. We can't just look at the few words different. We have to go back and really learn the mikra when it comes up. So that's sort of a by way of introduction. And so I've been working on that more lately and coming up, I think, with some very interesting insights by doing that, because once you go back and process the Chumash with using the Gemara's input and process the Gemara using all the pieces of the Chumash, you end up understanding the Chumash better and the Gemara better. So, with that in mind, let's learn this piece of Gemara, which seems to, I think, hold the key to a large portion, if not all, of the narrative of Yosef and his brothers, which is a halachic piece of Gemara. But we, Rabbi Yossi Bar Chanina, this is toward the bottom of page Zayin Amad Aleph, and you if somebody is asking for forgiveness from his friend, so in some way he slighted him and caused him pain. We had earlier in the Gemara used the phrase "machnitz chaveri afilu b'dvarim." He caused pain to his friend, even if it was only verbally. So now he has an obligation to rectify matters by asking forgiveness. So it says, but not more than three times. Yeah, three times, and if he's being stubborn about it, it's not your problem anymore. No, exactly why it's not your problem, that's something that needs to be analyzed. But you're only obligated to it three times. Shenema, how do we know? Ona, sona, v'ata, sona. And now this is coming from the Chumash. And again, this is as clear a support as you can bring from my premise in Rabbeinu Tam, because if you don't know Chumash, there's no way to know what's even happening. But basically, the Chumash at the end of Parashas Vayechi says like this, that after Yaakov Avinu passed away and they buried him, so it says, gracious non pasuk tefillah, but Yiru Achi Yosef ki meis Avinu. The brothers of Yosef saw that their father died. That's a funny language, that's all right. But Yemru Lu Yistamenu Yosef. He said, maybe Yosef is now going to carry on a vendetta against us. Of course, until now, maybe he was only holding back because he didn't want to do anything with the father around. But Hashav Yosef Lomitz Kolar Roshah Gamalno. See, now is his opportunity, without offending the father, to give us back all the bad things we did to him. But it's Savo Yosef Lehman. So, what did they do? They took an aggressive attack. They commanded him. They came in, they commanded him. We have important instructions from headquarters. We have a message from your father before he passed away. He gave us a message. How logical that is, that if the father wanted this to be accomplished, he'd give the message to them to give him. But this is what they tell me. He gave us the message. Koi samuli Yosef, you should go tell Yosef, Ono sono pesha achecho vachatosim kirog malucha. He said, please, you should forgive the misbehavior and the sin of your brothers who treated you badly. And that's his message. Being that that's his message. So now, please, if you don't mind taking that message to heart and actually grant God's forgiveness. Yosef cried when he spoke to him. Then the brothers came and they fell before him. And they said, "Hinenu l'chol avodim, will be your servant." And Yosef said to him, "Alti ro, don't worry about it. Yitzachas avikim ani vodim ma'i. I'm going to play God with you. Atem chashavtem alayim ro. Yeah, you guys had a bad attitude towards me and approached me in the wrong way. But avikim chashavu l'tayi, but Hashem was planning it all anyway in a good way. And it was all part of a process that's beneficial. To bring about the current situation where me being in my present position is able to bring sustenance to great masses of humanity. And so all the good things came out of it, so don't worry about it. So this piece of Gemara here in Yunus says that from here we see that you only have to ask three times, not more. Why? Because they asked him three times. Well, at least they used the word no, or variations of the word no, three times. Ona, sana, and again sana. Right? If you look in the Gemara says, ona, sana, v'ata, sana. Those words don't even come together in the Pasuk. They're cobbled together. Mm-hmm. The beginning it says, ona, sana, peshachacha. Later it says, v'ata, sana, l'fesha, adel, kevicha. So this is not even a fragment. This is a multiple fragment. And really, the first two things they didn't even say in their own voice. So your father said, please forgive them. They didn't even ask in their own voice. They asked theoretically in the name of the father. But that three times, three requests, two in the name of the father, one on their own. And it's a total of three. And that's all you have to ask, not more than three. So it sounds like the Gemara is saying that he didn't forgive them. Because if he did forgive them, then it doesn't prove anything. I mean, they happened to ask three times, but then he forgave them. And so how do you know how many times he asked if somebody's not forgiving him? So it sounds like they didn't forgive him. And that he didn't forgive them, I'm sorry. It sounds like from just the basis of this halacha that Gemara is deriving, it sounds like it's based on that premise that he did not forgive them. So, now the Rabbeinu Bechayi, Ala Torah, the commentary on the Torah, from someone who's sort of a Rishon, and he's not in the Masorah of Rishonim on the Gemara or anything like that, but it seems like he's from the period of Rishonim anyway. So he says, and this is widely quoted, you'll hear a lot of speeches in Shuls and Shabbos quoting it. He says that Yosef did not forgive them. And that because Yosef did not forgive them, that there was terrible punishments that happened later in history, because Yosef did not forgive them. That's what he says. And he doesn't quote this Gemara, but this seems to be a pretty direct source. What he says. Now, the Marsha ignores Rabbeinu Bechayi, doesn't even reference it, but the Marsha wades right into it and says, what do you mean? He didn't forgive them? That can't be. How could he not forgive them? Of course he forgave them. And again, the Marsha doesn't prove that he forgave them other than by his logic. He just says, you can't say he didn't forgive them. It's ridiculous. So, of course he forgave them. So the Rasha says, yeah, even he forgave them, but it could be that you could still, the Gemara means you could still learn it out, because since it mentions three requests for Mechila, so that becomes the prototype. And like you don't have to do more than what it says in the Torah. He doesn't explain it as fully as I was saying now. This is maybe a way of saving it. Because the way he says it sounds weaker. What he says it's extra or something like that, and we're going to learn out that this is how he asked before. But I think maybe you could say it in a way to make it that look, how do you know if this is the source for asking Mechila, period? So you never have to do more than the source says. The source says three times. But it could be the Gemara Shah didn't want to say it that way because we have an earlier source that's mentioned in the Gemara in Baba Kama that Hashem told us. I would know if he asked Mechila. But that's only one time. But so still, you know, if he asked once, and over here he had three times. But say we never find anyone in the Torah asking more than three times. So, you know, that would be sort of the basis of the Gemara Shah. But I think the Mashal has a bigger problem to deal with, which is where was the Mechila? Well, if we're going to say that, of course he did Mechila, it's obvious, how could he not do Mechila? The guy said, it's tzaddik, it's not going to not be Mechila, right? If that's the kind of approach the Mashal is taking, so where is it? Where's that Mechila? So, and the Torah is going to speak out their request and not speak out his Mechila? It's not really, it's not a strong argument in the presentation that the Torah would do that. So could be he learns like the Vayev Yosef and Avram Elov that they're crying somehow. That's the Mechila. But, so it's not so possible. The way Rashi is going is not so possible. But let's just clarify what we have here. So far we have two approaches. The one approach is the approach in the Rashi, which says that, of course he gave Mechila. Where is it? I don't know exactly. But of course he gave Mechila. So, if he gave Mechila, how do you learn from it? Of course, the Torah said three times, that's the teacher, that's the prototype. That's Marshall's way. And he has to deal with the downside of, the Mechila's not too obvious, right, is it? So that's his flaw in his approach. The flaw in the Reign of Achaia's approach is much stronger, I think. It's because the flaw in his approach is that if you say that Yosef was not Michael, it really goes against the flow of the entire narrative from the beginning. The whole point of the story, pretty much from the beginning of Yosef, is that other than a little side issues of, you know, a little too much vanity or things that Yosef, that as a person of greatness, he could have done a little smoother. In the chaser, little things, he's combing his hair too much, whatever it is, you know, a couple of things like that. But very mild. But basically, he's the good guy in the story. I mean, all the way through, that's the point. He's the one who he has his nevuahs, and he lived according to those nevuahs, and he never loses sight of the teachings of his father. And he's the one who, this story is not his issue, it's their issue. And it's taken them a long time to work their way back towards where they need to be in this manner. But presumably he's always been in the right place, they're working their way back to him. And even if it, again, all the flaws that Chazal see in him are all in a very narrow range, like he didn't correct them when they said, I will master your father. Very mild, because that was the natural talk. You always said, our servant, your father. It was a natural talk. You always said, you know, my master, I, your humble servant.
Yes, sir.
So he said, my father, your humble servant. So he probably was thinking, how am I going to stop him from doing that? But I'll say, he could have said, you know what, you have to respect your father just like you have to respect me. So how about, you call yourselves your servants, that's the protocol, but you don't have to call your father my servant. Something like that. Wouldn't have been so out of character. Something like that the Chazal want him to do, you know, that's their complaint. But these are very subtle complaints, but they're all within a person who really is on the right track all the way through. And so to suddenly say that at the end, they're the good guys who are asking Mechila, and he's the bad guy who doesn't want to give it, and that's the end of the story, is very jarring, and it's just, and there's no build-up or set-up or reason why we should think that. And by the way, even at the very end here, he's the one who has the nevuah of how the redemption is going to be, and he shares it with them. I mean, they learn about the nevuah of the redemption from him. So the Torah and the Torah is all very positive about him. So it's very hard to believe that in the middle of all this, suddenly he's the bad guy and he can't get over the issue. So I think that's a basic flaw that the Rabbeinu Chaya has. And by the way, here's the point where I have to tell you that Rav Hutno was my Rebbe, he's one of the great scholars of the past generation, but particularly in areas of Chumash and Agada that maybe some other scholars didn't specialize in. And he told a very close Talmud of his that did not to learn the Rebbein Bechai, he still learned the Rebbein Bechai, said, it's not on the authoritative level of Rishon like the Rashi and Ramban, so he told him. So a really close time, he didn't tell everybody, but someone who wanted to be engaging with Torah on a high level, he told them, not authoritative enough. So I think that Rabbeinu Bechai is definitely a valuable sefer, but at least that was his message, that if Rabbeinu Bechai is jarringly, you know, going in a direction that's problematic, you know, you don't need to necessarily take that as an authority. So there's a problem even in the flow of the text. But the other problem is this: neither of my shabbings, this never been behind this, is the fact that it's an open medrash rabba in Esther, Gilas Esther, medrash rabba, at the end of Parsha Zion, the medrash rabba right before Parsha Chasim. And the medrash says openly, "Umay Yosef," the medrash says, "Yosef, who was Michael's brother." And still, you see, there's a lot of punishments that came afterwards until the cheshbon got cleared up. So Kalsha came, when someone's not Michael, how bad it is. That's who the medrash. So he have an open medrash that says he was Michael. Now, we certainly justified in being reluctant in leaving the Gemara meaning that it was not Michael. So not a mashak, if it becomes much stronger, you know, we should be looking for the mashak. But still, the question is, where is the Mechila? So the fact is, the Medrash says, in that same Medrash, the Medrash says where the Mechila is. And I think by using that, we'll be able to explain the Gemara in a very nice way. Because remember, the Marsha is the biggest problem the Marsha has is that it's not really clear how you can learn that you don't have to ask Mechila anymore if Yosef was Michael then. If Yosef was Michael now, so then this is where a guy is Michael, through your request, but what about if the guy's not Michael? How do you know you don't have to ask him? So that was always the problem that Marsha was dealing with. He said, well, somehow they learn it out, they compare, they assume that he makes it a much weaker kind of address. But I think that you can use the Medrash in a way that really both preserves Marsha's premise, that of course Yosef was Michael, but also really answers his original class about it. And it goes like this. The Medrash says, in that Medrash in Esther Rabba, says that, Uma Yosef Shemach Alechem. It says, Yosef, who was Michael, his brother, Shanema. And then it says the Pasuk, where he was Michael. The Pasuk, where he was Michael, is in Parashat Vayigash, well before this Parashat. Because he said to him, Va'ata Alte Yosef, he said, then don't feel bad. Don't be angry at yourselves that you sold me. Because it's all part of Hashem's plan. So the Medrash is learning that that's a mechila. You can't tell someone, don't feel bad about doing it if you're not mindful. If they still need to ask a mechila, they have to feel bad until it's resolved. So if he said to them, don't feel bad. Don't eat yourself up about this. Because it all worked out for the best. That's a mechila. So the Medrash tells us where the mechila is, but the mechila is well before them asking the mechila. So now, I think if you take that Medrash and assume the Gemara holds like that Medrash, it works out beautifully in both directions. Because the whole fact that they ask him for mechila now is a huge chutzpah. Because he was Michael them the minute he told them who I am. Ani Yosef, the next pasuk. The pasuk's Dalet, Ani Yosef, pasuk Hey, he tells them, don't feel bad about selling me. And the manager says, that's a mechila. So he basically said to him, I'm Yosef, don't worry, I'm Michael you. And that's the basis of all future transactions and interactions between them. Is I'm Michael you, it's not a problem. Mm-hmm. Right? And then, as soon as the father dies, they say, oh, now he's going to get us. Which means, that after all it is, they still don't respect him. And they still don't trust him. And they still think he's a politician. And they figure that, and they treat him the exact same way like Esau. What did Esau say? Esau said, I want to get Yaakov, but I have to wait till my father dies to get him. Right? So they basically, after all that they went through, and all that he did for them, since they moved there, and he took care of them for 17 years and all of that, and the things he did to keep them out of from power, using them in ways that wouldn't be to their benefit, and all the things, everything that he had done for them, they're still alchemists. They never bought into it. They never bought the package. They still think, yeah, that's his, that he puts on a show, but now that he's got the power, of course he's going to wipe us out. So they come and they ask Mechila. Right? So it was the most offensive thing imaginable to ask him Mechila. It was the first thing he said to them. Is our Mechila? The first thing. I'm going to ask him, don't worry, I'm Mechila. Right? And so now, so the fact that he doesn't say Mechila now, why should he say Mechila now? He was Mechila them already. He cries when they ask him for Mechila. Because he's going, how do I get the message across? I tried everything, I was nice, I did everything right. I covered all the bases. I was positive to him every way I possibly can. They come in to ask me Mechila. Even more dramatic, by the way, is according to the Gemara in Yeronis, the Gemara brings one opinion that says that they lied to him. Their father didn't even tell them. The Gemara says, "I'm Rabbi Lom Shimon." Says in Yeronis Samachemet days, Rabbi Lom says the name of Rabbi Lazbar Shimon. Mutu le'adam l'shanas b'dvar Hashem. For the sake of peace, you're allowed to tell a lie or a misrepresentation. Shenema. So from the fact that they told him our father said that you should forgive us, we learn out that you could lie sometimes for the sake of peace. And Rashi says, Avichot Tziva, Yaakov Lo Tziva. He never commanded it. They created this fictional presentation to keep the peace, right? So, and by the way, if you want to use this Gemara, you could tie it. Is it a way of saving the Rebbeinu Bachari and making shalom between everybody? Because you know, as the Mashal says, how can you say he wasn't my wife? Right? How can you say that? It's terrible, you can't say that. And the Rebbeinu Bachari says, no, he wasn't my wife. He just says he cried, he wasn't my wife. What was your wife? Right? Oh, because over here, we don't see a Mechila here. It seems like. So I'm saying that you can take a middle position and say, no, he was my father. And Marshall is right. The crime was a Mechila. What happened here, it was a Mechila. But the Rebbeinu Bachai is still right that the Mechila didn't work. Why? Because they obtained the Mechila under false pretenses. They came and said, your father said, it should be Michael. Right? So he was Michael based on their presentation. So, L'chaira, a Mechila based on false pretenses. And certainly in financial transactions, it's true that a Mechila betayed. If I forgive someone a debt or something like that, based on fraudulent information, it's not valid. So in this type of mechila, probably the same thing. If you fake a guy out to be mad for you, by telling him, the rabbi said you need to be mad for me. I just came back from the rabbi. He said, you need to be mad for me. So you figured, all right, the rabbi said, so I'm mad for you. Now you come up in heaven. Can you use that mechila? Does it have validity? No, you told him the rabbi said, that's all it was. Now, could be Yosef would have been Michael if they asked him straight, but if they asked him this way, they said, our father said. Two out of the three requests are in the father's voice, right? It's not even in their voice. The father asked, please be Michael. So, if he says yes, he could be responding to the presentation, which makes the mechila invalid. So that would be a way to incorporate both views. You could say, of course, he meant to be mochel, but because of their own fraudulent representation, which they did in the Pnei Hashomah, maybe a lateral on that level, but as a mechila, halachically, it wasn't very effective because, okay, so I'm just showing you that there's different ways to approach that. But in the mahalach that we're going, we want to say like this, that really both are true. He was not Michael now, but the reason why he was not Michael now is not because he's got issues. The reason he's not Michael now is because he was Michael before. Okay, he's just being a tzaddik that he doesn't have, he can have a whole basis for a whole new hakpada. He has the right to demand a new mechila. The chutzpah of you guys, after what I did for you, and I was mocking you from day one, and you come to me as if I wasn't mocking you, right? So he, if anything, he had a right to start a whole new file, just for the fact that he is mechila. That itself is an affront. But he chose, you know, to be classy about it. But the point is, I'm saying that this is, if you do the math on this, it comes out a very nice mahalach, because on the one hand, this is a proof that you only have to ask mechila three times, because in that terms, well, they thought they still needed mechila. They never bought into his mechila, right? So in that terms, he's not being mechila now, he's just crying. And they throw themselves down, and right after he cries, and say, "We'll be your servants," because they're reading it that he's not being mechila. They ask him, and he's crying. So they say, "Oh, hey, all right, don't kill us. We'll be your servants." So they're reading. So you could still, you know, some of the things that the Rebbeinu Chai is responding to could be, we can incorporate those in our understanding. That they're getting the message that the mechila request is being rebuffed, and he's just saying, "Well, you know, I'm not bothering you. You go." But they're not hearing a mechila from him. But he, in his perspective, what do you mean? I was mechila them from day one. I told him right off the bat. So once we set up this approach to the Gemara, so now I think we can enhance it by incorporating an earlier piece that. That the Daf Yomi Internet Kotel already helped us some years back in the first cycle that the Kotel was acting in the Daf Yomi on the Gemara in Tainus. Gemara in Tainus is a very odd sequence. The Gemara starts off by saying, it's in the Testament page, right? The Gemara starts off by saying that if a person, no, you don't know. You don't go. The Gemara starts off by saying that if a person couldn't fast on a particular day, maybe for medical reasons, or by mistake, started eating, whatever it is, but he's not succeeding in making the fast day today, so basically he's off the hook. The Gemara says, yeah, but he still should not eat a fancy dinner in front of people who are fasting. Because he's motivated, so he eat discreetly, but don't make a public spectacle and out of the fact that you're not bound by the same restriction that they are, and make them feel good about it. The Gemara says, what's the proof? What's the source? The source is from the fact that Yaakov sent his children to get food. It says, "Vayomer Yaakov Levonov Loma Tisro." When Yaakov sent his children, he sent in a preface. But he didn't say, "Why should we stop for that? Gotta go get food." He said that later, the second time he sent me. But the first time he sent me, he said, "Loma Tisro." What does that word mean? It's an odd conjugation of the verb ria of seeing, but so what exactly is he saying? So the Gemara said it means, why should we have people looking at us? Maybe go join the lines and ask for food. Why should it be? So what does that mean? The point is that he really has food. Because this, apparently this strategy of that Yosef taught to the Egyptians to save for a rainy day, and of course in the particular case of Pari, where he had a specific dream, that so he knew that he has to move quickly. But the basic approach he learned already in his father's house, that his father had stored food. They didn't rely on, going shopping every day. They kept food in storage. That was part of the family culture. maybe started with Avraham, with Achnas Tzarechem, you know, whatever it is. But that was part of our Jewish approach to life, was, you know, you don't leave yourself out there exposed. So you make sure you have your backup. So he had food, but the people around him were not, I didn't have as much force in it. So consequently, he said, listen, we can't sit here and be eating, having a good time, because we're going to make these people feel good. But interesting, they weren't afraid that the people are going to be stronger than them and send them off to take their food away. They were confident in their strength, the way the Gemara learns. But they didn't want to make those people feel good. So, then after introducing that interpretation, the Gemara seems to veer off to a much later event, when this is after Yosef tells his brothers his identity. So that means in between, this is the first time Yaakov sent them, they came back with the whole confusion, Shimon is in jail, and he wants Benjamin to come. Then some months go by before they run out of food, and Yaakov says, you better go. And bring Benjamin, and then they go, and then they leave again, and then he waylays them on the road, brings them back, says he stole my stuff. The whole thing. And then finally, he reveals himself. And at that point, he says, okay, go home and get our father, and if you move down here, that'll be the best solution. So, what he tells them, at that point, I'll tell you Zubadar, he says, but don't get too agitated on the road. You know, get home, go smooth without drama. So what is that reference to? I'm going to be so the Gemara says different approaches. One opinion says, don't get too caught up in Torah. If you learn Torah on too deep a level, you'll get distracted, you'll miss the turnoff, you know, you'll get in trouble. And the Tana they bring from a bride said that it means don't take a certain type of arrogant strides that in some spiritual way endanger a person. There's certain forces that are sent built into nature that don't like to see people too arrogant, because this is, oh, you think it's such a big shot, we have ways to keep you humble. And then that's another thing, another interpretation of what he was telling them not to do. Then one interpretation says he was telling them not to travel at night, it's dangerous. So, and that's it. And then the Gemara goes off and back to things concerning fast days. So, a very odd sequence here. Sometimes you see a one piece of Gemara, and they'll go through like the story of Yaakov. Let's say over here, we go through the story all the way through, all the steps. And you could go on for three pages like that and go each passage and analyze. That's not what's happening here. They just do this segue from Yaakov's original message to them was, we have food, but we need to make sure we don't make people feel bad, and they should. We don't want people to be aware of how much food we have. And then he said, oh, by the way, when he sent it back in that last time, this is what he means when he told them, don't get agitated. It's like, it's very odd. So what we explained was that this is in a Sefer I wrote called Mar B'Shalom that came out in 1993, I believe. That and we offer this idea there's a certain, the Chazal, in a short way, going back to Ravina time of the Blue, in a short way, the Chazal are giving us a coded signal of how to learn up what happened when Yosef revealed himself to the brother. Because whatever this advice is, whatever advice he gave them, is advice that they should have known long before this. Because they had already made four trips. The father sent them, they went back, there's two trips. Mm-hmm. And his father sent them another time, there's three trips. They went halfway back, three and a half trips already. And now when he says, okay, go and pack up the moving vans, and that's when he says, oh, by the way, he starts talking to them, advice on how to travel. And there's no new advice here that's particular to that circumstance. It's all things that are basic. Rashi and Chumash says that on the level of Pshat, Rashi says that when he told them, don't get agitated, he meant don't start fighting with, among yourselves about selling me and going back over the piss and just let's move forward and forget about that stuff. See, that fits. That's something new. But here, the Gemara takes you away from that. No. This is, he's giving them various advice that any Jew needs to know in his favor. So what happened? How come they didn't know it before? How come when Yaakov never told it to them? What's going on? So he said like this, that the Gemara is cluing us into a beautiful analysis. I mean, it's beautiful in the reading, it's tragic in the event. Of what happened between Yosef and them when he revealed himself to them. Because he revealed himself to them and said, it's all good, no problem. And he says, and now all I want you to do is go to our father. Maharu v'alu alavi, hurry up, go to dad. Tell him as follows. This is what your son Yosef says. Samani elokim la'adin l'chol mitzrayim. God has made me the master of Egypt. Right? That's the message. And simple message. Nothing about him. He doesn't say, I'm saying. He says, God made me the king of Egypt. Right? Beautiful. So what did they say when they got home? They go right home and they come in and they tell the father the good news, and they tell him, oh, Yosef Chai is still alive. Oh, he's also the leader of Egypt. What happened to God made him the leader of Egypt. That was the message. Not that I'm the leader of Egypt. Hashem made you the leader of Egypt. Did that. That they didn't include. Which means that really, he did not succeed in getting them to buy. And that's the real tragedy. That here they sold him and they went on in the same place with him, and it used to be very severe, the gap between them. And now already they're willing to trust him enough to move there, but they're not buying into the idea that he's the biggest tzaddik, or that he's the one who's the prophet, or that he's the one who understands what Hashem is doing. And they're always concerned, listen, what Hashem is doing, and that's Hashem, we don't know. This is indisputable that he's the leader of Egypt. So they're not macabre him, even after he reveals himself to them. They're not still accepting his message to them from day one, which is that I have a certain role here, a divinely ordained role, to provide certain leadership in the family. They're still not buying them. And so therefore the Chazal is saying like this, that he gave them advice of how to travel, but all those little pieces of advice are all advice that if you're a shliach mitzvah, if you're going on a holy mission, you don't need to worry about this stuff. It's a special dispensation when you're a shliach mitzvah. You don't have to worry about the little things. You're not like going to a real dangerous place. You can't walk through in the middle of the intifada. You can't walk through this because you're doing a mitzvah. But other than that, The little things you do in life, to avoid increasing your risk level from 1% to 2%, and which you don't take on unnecessary risk in life, but there's a special dispensation so that you're doing a mitzvah, you don't worry about that little stuff like that. And so because he saw that they're not buying into, he wants them, he believes all of this became a mitzvah, the whole process is a mitzvah. From day one it was the mitzvah. Hashem is setting this whole thing up, and everything you do to advance this process is all part of following the nevuah that I came to you with to begin with. But they're still not accepting that. So since they're not accepting it, he says, well, okay, everybody's saying, so you're not accepting it, so I'm going to have to tell you that you better observe those halachas. When I hear it in the piece that's in the sefer is a chesmen that really until then, they were always doing a mitzvah. That's part of the Gemara before. Because the Gemara before says they never needed the food. They were always going not to make the neighbors feel bad. So they were really always going and doing a mitzvah. So at every stage they were doing a mitzvah. The only time, and even if you sit around and food the second time, but they were going to do pidyon, to get shimon, whatever it is, there was always a mitzvah what they were doing. But now, if if they're going home to pick up the father, and it's just, and it's only for their convenience, but it's really, it's not part of this divinely ordained thing, so then there really is no mitzvah anymore. So that's what he's saying to them. And then you have to say another piece, because Shluchim Mitzvah really works on the way back too, so they came to do it. But since they sort of, at this point, either you say they started going back already, this is, you know, this is not the going back anymore, mm-hmm. because they went back, but he pulled them back. So you know, you say that. Or you could say that that it's not, by, since they decided to move here now, they're not, then it's not, they're not going back anymore. They really live here now, and they're going to get their father. They change it. But anyway, however, it's the chesed. But the point is, they no longer have a mitzvah to hang their hat on. And so he says, well, yeah, if so, then you guys have to observe these laws. Which is it's his way in code of saying, I'm a little disappointed in you guys that you're not accepting my assessment that all this is a mitzvah. And there's another, there's a beautiful pasuk that provides the bridge for this. Because the pasuk right before he gives them all that advice, travel advice, says like this. Well, actually, the two segments of the pasuk. It says, "Vayishalach es echo." It says he sent his brothers. Vayelechu, and they went. Vayomraleim, and he said to them, "Al tigazu b'darach, don't get agitated on the road." It's out of sequence. He sent them, they went, and then he tells them, by the way, if this was the message that they needed to have, it should say it the other way. He told them how to travel, then he sent them, then they went. So by writing it out of sequence, the Torah is communicating us like this, that he sent them in the hopes that he could get them to do it his way. Vayelechu, when they went, he saw that they're going that way. They're not accepting his idea that Hashem is doing this, and that it's all a mitzvah. And once he saw that they're not accepting and they're going that way, then Vayomraleim, I'll take this over there. And he said, well, if you're going that way, then I think you'll have no mitzvah at all on this trip. In which case, you better watch out on all of these halachas. So in a sort of coded way, we're following through that the debate continues, even after this sort of reconciliation, but the debate continues. And that's really dramatized by the fact that they come to him now, and they think he's going to be like Esav, he was really bearing his grudge the whole time. Add to that the Medrash that says that what he said to them in the very first pasuk is a mechila. So now, again, if everything is really in sync. Because in his system, then he covered his bases right off the bat. He said, I'm Yosef, I'm Michael, not a problem. It's really all Hashem's plan. And nothing is a problem. I don't even view that you are actors in this story. You are really pawns. And so, but I'm Michael, he says, no reason for you to even feel bad about it. So this is over. And then, on the contrary, let's keep doing the mitzvah by bringing the father. Tell him that Hashem put me here, we're going to do the mitzvah. They said, well, we're not going into the mitzvah part, but it's probably a good idea to move. So, alright. Then they come to me afterwards and say, in the mechila, and according to the one opinion, they even said a lie, that the father says to do the mechila, which they didn't do. And by the way, how does the Gemara know that the father is saying? They came and said, the father said. So the Gemara said, oh, you see, you can make up a story. How did they know that? There's only one logical reason why the Gemara knows that. It's because the Gemara holds that they never told them. The Gemara holds from the fact that the Chumash never indicated that they told him the story, that probably they never told him. And which
he never
means,
told
them. What?
He never told them.
No, so Yosef never told them, and the brothers never told them.
Well, oh, I never told them.
In other words, Yosef never complained to the father, and because the father did not say, give them instructions. And they never told him.
Mm-hmm.
At least this one number, because that's really the only logic to say that they made it up. How do you know they made it up?
Mm-hmm.
Why not? Because the father was giving all kinds of last minute instructions in all directions. Other than that, it's illogical that he would tell them, he should have told them, but that's built into the story. They're coming and saying he told them. So they didn't think it was that illogical, or they wanted to present it. So apparently that wouldn't be out of character to do that. So why, how could the Gemara be so sure they made it up? The only reason I think logically why the Gemara could be sure they made it up is because the Gemara doesn't believe that in the way that the story is set up, that they have atonement. So that basically they just left it, since he never told the father. They left it that they found his thing on the road. But, so the father figured that probably after the animal tore off his garment, that he was only wounded and he didn't die. And somewhere along the line, he pulled himself together, someone rescued him, and he ended up in Mitzrayim, that's all. And didn't ask any more questions, right? And he figured if my son has something to tell me, he wants to tell me, he'll share with me, if not, I'm not going to be nosy about it. Probably went through hard times. And so if that's the way the Gemara is reading the story, like we said, you know, filling the gaps in the narrative, so then there's really a lot of reasons for Yosef to still have faith in him. Not a problem. He says, look, I was mocking you from day one. I was mocking you based on the premise that Hashem is running this whole operation, and that's how it is. And now he cries, and I think the way to understand the crying is in this context, like we said before, they still won't come over to see it on my side, to see that I gave them the nevuah from them. By the way, to sort of round out this division of things, this is something I wrote to Rabbi Israel in a different letter, is that, you know, people ask, why did Yosef tell them the dreams to begin with? And then, if he told them the first one and it backfired, then really, what was he telling the second one for? Right? So I think, and I think the Gemara Brachot supports this view, that I think that the insight is like this, that really, if you study the dreams carefully without having an attitude about it, you know, then you can see that he really wasn't, he was really very measured in what he was asking them to accept. Because the first dream, in Parashas, in the beginning of Vayeshev, it says like this. It says, V'hine anachtu ma'almi ma'luma, v'sei chasada. We were making bundles of wheat in the field, harvesting. V'hine kam ma'lumasi v'gam nitzada. My bundle got up, stood tall. V'hine t'subena aluma y'sechem. Then your bundles turned around, and they bowed to my bundle. So now, that means that we're going to do the artist conception of this scene, right? So they are in the scene. He said, all the humans are in the scene. All 12 brothers appear in the scene as humans. For the 12 humans, they're doing bundles. His bundle gets up, and their bundles bow. But that means that he's there, and they're not bowing to him. Only the bundles are bowing. So in the dream, the perspective is built in where he's saying, look, I'm not really going to be the king on the level that your whole life is going to be beholden to me, and you're going to be in a constant state of bowing to me. But in the very specific area of the finances, of the bundles of wheat, in that very specific area, you're going to need me, and I'm going to have a certain role, a leadership role, but it's limited to the area. So it's in the original prophecy that he's sharing with them. This really shouldn't be that threatened. And they didn't buy it. Okay. So now, he comes back with the second dream. Now, what's the second dream? The second dream really is taking into account that sensitivity and making it even better. Because what does it say in the second dream? It says, "Hinei chalamti chalom." I have another dream. "Hinei hashemesh vayirech," the sun, the moon, "v'chadasar kochavim," and 11 stars, "mishtachim liabamim." So now, how many humans are in this dream? Only one. He's a human. He doesn't say he's a star. He's a human. Now, the one thing we learn from Pari's dream is that, unless stated otherwise, any object that's mentioned in one of these dreams is in its natural position. In other words, because when Pari says he's standing on the river, then they speak it out. That's a weird thing, he's actually standing on the river. That's not normal. But other than that, When, if you say, if someone's standing, you assume he's standing in a normal way. If someone's sitting, he's sitting. If it, and so you assume things are in normal position in the dream. Now, if that's the case, that means if he's the only human in the dream, and there's the sun, the moon, and the stars, that means that they're in the sky and he's on the ground. That's what humans are on the ground. It doesn't say he's in the sky. It doesn't say the stars are on the ground. So now, he's on the ground, and they're in the sky, and they're bowing some kind of a curtsy that you're doing from above in the sky, right? But in this dream, he's saying, you're the stars. I'm the guy on the ground who's giving you parnasa so that you can be up in the stars with Yaakov, this son, and working the highest levels of spirituality, and I'm taking this job in a self-sacrificing way to be the man on the ground for you. Understand? So here he really is saying to them, all right, it's not, we're not even just, in the first dream we were already humans on the same plane, and it's only in this one area. Now he's saying, not even that, well, in spiritual terms, you're going to be able to accomplish more than me, because I'm going to be busy all day in the government office over there, you know, negotiating with all these characters and fighting over budgets and all the crazy stuff. And while you guys get to sit and learn. So, you're the stars. So the fact that you're bound to me, that you that much you, and still, no, they can't take it. They can't accept it. So after all of that, and then even now when they come to me, says, not a problem, don't worry about it, it's all beautiful. And the same thing, you come here, you'll sit and learn, I have to do this job, but I'll make it in ways Pari won't even notice you, he won't hire you, he won't put you down, he won't do anything, right? That's what he did, it's a whole setup. Yeah, I'll tell him you're a bunch of shepherds, you leave them alone, you know, they're eccentrics, let them stay over there. And every step of the way through, he was absolutely consistent with the initial vision, all his behaviors, nothing out of line. And the few little places where he went off is that, you know, a little too carried away by his looks, you know, which were given him to facilitate what he was doing, but he enjoyed himself in the front of the mirror a little too much in the process. Okay, so they got him on a technicality. But basically, all the way through, he really stuck to that vision and never diverged from it. And they stuck to their resistance, unfortunately. And they moved enough that they agreed that we could live here and stuff like that, but it's really tragic that they never really fully got to the place. And so that even if to some extent the Rebbeinu Bechai ends up being true that there was some lack of mechila that happened, but it's not because of Yosef. That even if they ended up with a lack of mechila, it's ironic, but that it's caused in their own fault. Either because they wouldn't accept that as mechila, because his mechila came with sort of terms where you have to believe that Elohim Hashem is running this whole show and doing this, and they won't buy that type of mechila, so they're sort of resisting, rejecting that kind of mechila. Well, the other way you say it, that because they came in and asked, if you learn the mechila happened later, that they came and asked for the mechila under the false pretenses, which it was all even the false pretenses, they didn't need it because he really was on their side and was there to be mindful. And had they asked on their own basis, they would have granted it, but they asked on the father's basis, they granted it on that basis, and maybe on that technically didn't make the mechila work for them. And so therefore, that's what I'm saying, that however we come out at the end, if to some extent there really was no mechila, so the one way to learn is, no, it absolutely was a mechila. The mechila was earlier, and like the magician Esther says, that his mechila worked, and any punishments they had later, it was only for the parts that Hashem still punishes, even after the mechila. That's what the Medrash says. I'm saying, even if you say the Talmud Bavli adopts that the Rebbeinu Bechai is right in the Talmud Bavli, then maybe there is some element of where the mechila is not working fully, but that's still like, it's from their fault, rather than from his fault. Because to suddenly change the narrative that he became the bad guy at the end, it's not supported by the whole presentation of the thing. So I think this to give us some understanding, but go back to when I started, that in the Rebbeinu Tam, that if you go back to the Mikra and you learn the Parsha and you learn the Hamshah, how things are proceeding, using the material from the Gemara, you find that you understand the Pesukim better, and you find that you understand the Gemara better. Yeah.
Questions?
Fantastic.